Good morning, Next. It's great to be with you. Great to have you online with us this morning. What I want to do is I want to help us understand the revolutionary nature of the Apostle Paul, which can be hard to do these days because we often suffer from presentism. And that's defined this way. It's the uncritical adherence to present-day attitudes, especially the tendency to interpret past events in terms of modern values and concepts. And so Paul's brilliance in the Bible, I think, is often lost. His revolutionary work is lost on us modern readers a lot of times. And I think that's a crying shame. And so what I want to do is I want to help us recover that. And I want to bring him into dialogue, actually, with one of his contemporaries, a man named Pliny. Now, both Pliny and Paul wrote letters in their day. They both happened to write a letter about similar circumstances. What a person should do with runaway slaves. And so I want to compare and contrast their views on this issue. And to do that, I want to take a hard look at their letters. Now, letters have become a bit of a foreign concept to us, right? I mean, when was the last time you received an actual letter in the mail? I mean, I guess it's, for some of us, it's probably never in our lives, or some of us, it's probably been years, at least a decade. And I would venture to guess that for most of us, it probably almost feels weird to receive a letter these days instead of an email. I mean, the art of letter writing is almost gone, except in one small area, the Christmas letter. I'm not sure if you still get these, but Kirsten and I, we get one from her side of the family, an aunt, an uncle, something like that. They write us a Christmas letter every year, send it out to the family, giving us updates on what's happening with their family. It's strange. It's a Christmas tradition, I suppose. That's what some people do, but it feels kind of weird to me. But that's kind of the only place that letter writing exists today. And letters are a funny thing, right? Hardly writes them anymore, and they're quickly becoming a thing of the past. But I did stumble across a funny little website that's called Dear Blank. And it's a website that encourages people to write very short imaginary letters. And some of them are hilarious to me. Let me read a few of them to you. They go like this. Dear Iceberg, sorry to hear about the global warming. Enjoy the karma. Sincerely, the Titanic. Dear Waldo, please return my invisibility cloak ASAP. Sincerely, H. Potter. Dear Twilight fans, thank you for making this look sane and well-adjusted. Sincerely, Trekkies. Dear windshield wipers, can't touch this. Sincerely, that little triangle. Dear musicians, please stop putting sirens in your songs. Sincerely, just slammed on my brakes. Dear subconscious, so I can't finish the good dreams, but the nightmares have sequels? Sincerely, we need to talk. Dear Noah, we could have sworn you said the ark wasn't leaving till 5. Sincerely, the unicorns. Dear people of the world, I don't mean to sound slutty, but please use me whenever you want. Sincerely, grammar. Dear movie watcher, your parents are about to walk in. Sincerely, the only sex scene in the movie. And dear Diet Coke, I feel you're overreacting. Sincerely, Mentos. Those crack me up. Those are funny imaginary letters, but in day-to-day life, right, email has largely replaced it. It's a bit of a lost art, but in the ancient world, outside of one-on-one interaction, right, or letter writing was the only mode of communication. And so both Pliny and Paul write letters prompted by some kind of problem. A slave has run away. And someone, the slave owner, needs advice on what to do. And so we have these ancient letters, and they're fascinating to me. I mean, it's like eavesdropping in on a different era of history. And what we find in these letters is, I think, still instructive for us today. And so I want to introduce you to the Pliny family. And the letter that we're going to look at is from Pliny the Younger, not to be confused with the more famous Pliny the Elder. You see, Pliny the Elder, he was this naturalist, author, philosopher, and he was a contemporary of Paul, but he died, actually, during the eruption of Mount Vesuvius in AD 79. And of course, we know that volcano, it buried Pompeii. But being a naturalist, when this was happening, Pliny was so curious that he decided instead of running away, he was going to take a ship to get a better look at the volcanic eruption. And that was clearly a mistake. He got too close. His men apparently on the ship tried to convince him to turn back. But it's said that he cried out, "Fortune favors the brave." And he carried on. And that was the last anyone heard from Pliny the Elder. But Pliny the Younger was the nephew of Pliny the Elder. And by the time we catch up with Pliny the Younger years later, he's got quite the reputation of his own. He was a very important man in the Roman world. He served as a senator, a lawyer, a politician. He was a civil servant. And eventually he was dispatched to be the governor of the province of what would be northern Turkey today. So Trajan's emperor at the time. And so we still have this letter of correspondence from Pliny the Younger sent to Trajan asking him about policy issues. So we've got a lot of correspondence from him. And interestingly enough, one of the policy issues he asked Trajan the emperor about is what he should do with these Christians he keeps hearing about. Keep popping up, they're causing a bit of a nuance. But in another one of his letters, he ends up addressing a similar situation as Paul. What do you do with runaway slaves? Now, I need to offer this very quickly. There's differences between slavery as we think of it today and slavery in the ancient world. For us, right, we often think slavery is bound up and tied to ethnicity or gender, right? So we can think of sex slavery, so that would involve mostly girls, or we might think of a practice where nations literally steal people, most often from, Africa, take them by the boatloads, send them off to the New World or Europe, right, to serve in servitude. And of course, slavery in any time or period is evil, but in the ancient world, it was a much more common practice because anyone could be a slave. It wasn't tied to ethnicity or gender. It was tied to conquest and poverty. So for instance, if you're a nobleman and you have slaves of your own, right, but your city gets sacked by another city, voila, you could turn into a slave. You could end up in slavery. Or let's say you find yourself in a period of bad luck. You're on hard times. You're broke. You could sell yourself into slavery. It was kind of the bankrupt option, right? So slavery wasn't as much about ethnicity or gender. It was simply what you did when you happened to be on hard times or when hard times come to you in your city. But we often think today about slavery as a life sentence. In the ancient world, it wasn't that either. You could work your way out of slavery. You could become what was called a freedman, which was someone who wasn't technically a slave anymore. So they could technically leave their master at any time, but oftentimes they still lived kind of like a slave, you know, keep a certain measure, standard of living. And so freedmen were still often totally dependent on their former slave owners, but they did have the option of leaving if they could, if they wanted to. And this is the situation we have with Pliny the Younger. And there's some remarkable, similarities and differences between Pliny's case and Paul's, but Pliny starts out this way. An unnamed young man who happened to be a freedman has somehow offended Pliny's friend Sabinius. And the letter from Pliny is the counsel he gives to his friend about this situation. This is how the letter goes. Pliny the Younger to Sabinius, you told me you had been angry with a freedman of yours, and now he's come to see me. He threw himself at my feet and clung on to me as though I were you. He wept a lot, he asked for a lot, though he kept quiet about a lot too. To sum it up, he made me believe that he was genuinely sorry. I think he is a changed character because he really does feel that he did wrong. Yes, I know you're angry, and I know too that you have a right to be angry, but mercy earns most praise when anger is fully justified. Once you love this fellow, and I hope you will love him again, for the moment it's enough if you let yourself be placated. You can always be angry again if he deserves it, and you'll have all the more reason if you've been placated now. He's young, he's in tears, and you have a kind of heart. Make all that count. Don't torture him, and don't torture yourself either. Anger is always torture for a soft heart like yours. I'm afraid it will look as though I'm putting pressure on you, not simply making a request if I join my prayers to his, but I'm going to do it anyway, and all the more fully and thoroughly, because I've given him a sharp and severe talking to, and I've warned him clearly that I will not make such a request again. This was because he needed a good fright, and I said it to him rather than to you, because it's just possible that I shall make another request and receive it too, always supposing it's an appropriate thing for me to ask and for you to grant. Yours sincerely, Pliny the Younger. This is remarkable to me. Something's gone wrong. We don't know exactly what. Something's gone wrong. This slave has made Sabinius angry. And I find Pliny's advice to his friend intriguing and telling. I want to showcase a few things about this letter. First, note the social hierarchy at work. We have three stages here. Pliny is high up. Sabinius is in this sort of upper middle class position. Then this unnamed young slave or freedman is the lowest. Pliny, higher class. Sabinius, middle class. Unnamed young man is a virtual slave. And second, notice the nature of his advice. And some of these quotes are great, and I think they stand well to reason. I like a lot of what Pliny actually says. But notice his advice is aimed towards Sabinius's pride and reputation. He tells him to have mercy on this young man because mercy earns most praise when anger is fully justified. And anger is always torture for a soft heart like yours. His advice is based on what is best for Sabinius, what is best for him, is his pride and reputation. And moreover, there's a third thing to notice here. There's a big power move here. Notice Pliny tells him that he should always do, or he should do always, supposing that it's an appropriate thing for Pliny to ask him for something and for him to grant it. And so in the end, we have a slave goes to Pliny, begs him to convince someone with less power to show him mercy. And the man in power agrees by pulling a power move of his own and appealing to his friend's pride and reputation. But what I find very interesting at the end of the day about this letter is this. In the end, everyone is staying in the same place within the social hierarchy order as when they started. So Pliny's advice, which sounds more like a command to Sabinius, is this. Yep, you're angry, but you're going to look so virtuous. If you show some mercy here, it's going to be good for your reputation. It's going to look good on you. People will think you're something special. Besides, being angry, it's not a good look on someone in your position in society. So just let this go. And ultimately, for Pliny, maintaining the status quo is what is important. There's no sense making a big deal of this. Let's just keep living in an untroubled world where everyone stays where they are in the social hierarchy. It's as if he's saying, you know, let, we men of reputation should just put on a nice veneer of everything being okay. For Pliny, the important thing in a conflict situation would be maintaining the status quo and coming out of it looking good to others. That's sort of the plan. That's the advice. Now, Paul's approach in a very similar situation has some similarities, but also some differences to Pliny. So this letter actually comes from Paul when Paul is in prison. And he's presumably under house arrest from what we can tell. And while he's there in prison, along comes a man named Onesimus. So we have the name of this slave, this runaway slave, Onesimus. And it's not just any runaway slave. It's a runaway slave for a man named Philemon, who was Paul's friend and partner in church planting. And so we don't exactly know what the falling out was between Philemon and Onesimus. Maybe Onesimus stole something. We don't know. But there's this falling out. Onesimus runs away, runs to Paul, and it puts Paul in this difficult position because what's Paul going to do? The prevailing Pliny wisdom of the day would be to just say, hey, you got to go back, maintain the status quo. Well, what does he do? Well, Paul performs a very risky endeavor here. He sends Onesimus back to Philemon with a letter for him. And the letter begins with some greetings, breaks the ice a little, and we pick it up partway through. This is what Paul says to Philemon. My dear brother, your love gives me so much joy and comfort. You have refreshed the heart of God's people. Because of all of this, I could be very bold in the king and order you to do the right thing. But because of love, I'd much rather appeal to you. Yes, it's me, Paul speaking, an old man as I am and now a prisoner of King Jesus. I'm appealing to you about my child, the one I have fathered here in prison, Onesimus, Mr. Useful. There was a time when he was useless to you, but now he's very useful to me and to you. And I'm sending him to you, yes, the man himself. And this means sending my own heart. That way, when you did the splendid thing that this situation requires, it wouldn't be under compulsion, but of your own free will. Look at it like this. Maybe this is the reason he was separated from you for a while, so that you could have him back forever, no longer as a slave, but much more than a slave, as a beloved brother, beloved especially to me, but how much more to you, both as part of your household and in the Lord. So anyway, if you reckon me a partner in your work, receive him as though he was me. And if he's wronged you in any way or owes you anything, put that down on my account. This is me, Paul, writing with my own hand here. I'll pay you back. And far be it for me to remind you that you owe me your own very self. Yes, my brother, I want some benefit from you in the Lord. Refresh my heart in the King. As I write this, I'm confident that you'll do what I say. In fact, I know you'll do more than I say. But at the same time, get a guest room ready for me. I'm hoping you see that through your prayers, I'll be granted to you. The grace of the Lord, King Jesus, be with your spirit. Oh, I love this letter so much. It might be one of my favorite books by Paul because it's just dripping with so much fascinating goodness. But let's start with the obvious comparison here between this letter and Pliny's. Both Pliny and Paul use power moves here, right? In how they handle the situation. There are massive power plays at work here. What do we think of that? Are power moves over people ever appropriate? I mean, let's compare these letters, shall we? I think the first thing to simply say is this. Power exists. We're never going to get rid of the world of power. Power simply exists. There are a multitude of ways to get and use power. You can have power based on your gender or on the color of your skin. You can also get and use power based on competence or achievements or attractiveness or personality or character. I mean, there's a million ways to get power. And so much of that is situational. It depends on the context. Some ways of using and obtaining power are more legitimate than others. But the reality is power exists. It's allotted to people for a whole host of reasons. And so the question to me is not, should people have power? To me, that's asking, should people have gravity? Well, that doesn't make a ton of sense. Gravity exists, power exists. Some people have more than others. And for some, that's fair. Some of it is not fair at all. But to me, the better question is this. How should people who have power use it? Power exists. So how do we use it? Note what Pliny does with his power, right? For him, it's maintain social order, maintain social hierarchy. Expect people to do what you want based on your power. That's Pliny's power move. Ah, but what does Paul do with his power? Let me get to that in a moment, but also notice here where Paul roots his power, right? He keeps appealing not to his own status. He keeps appealing to what? To Jesus, King. King Jesus is the source of his authority, and Jesus is remaking the world, is now sort of governing the world in a different way, and he roots his power there, not in Paul's social standing. And Paul ends up bragging about two things in his letters, being old and being a prisoner. And this is intriguing to me because those were both things that in ancient times, even today, signal someone who doesn't actually have a legitimate claim to power. Why should anyone listen to someone who's old? Moreover, why should anyone listen to someone who's in jail, a prisoner? I mean, let's be honest, would you take advice from someone sitting in jail? But Paul brags about it. Why? Again, he roots his power in Jesus, and in Jesus' kingdom, all notions of power are turned upside down. And so Pliny writes from this high position. He's the statesman, the lawyer. He's the big deal in the Roman Empire. But for Paul, he doesn't brag or root his power in his social standing. He roots it in Jesus. He roots it in the things that make people lower in social hierarchy. And so he writes from someone who's in a low position to someone who's in a high position about someone else who's in a low position. And what does Paul do? Well, basically, he starts the letter by encouraging Philemon before he asks him to do a hard thing. He starts with the encouragement, right? Your joy, your love, your joy gives me so much pleasure. You've refreshed the heart. You know, he's laying it on a little thick. And that's instructive to me, though. He starts with encouragement, a reminder about, listen, there's a lot of good things happening. Even if this situation is difficult, there's a lot of good happening. But something's gone wrong. In this church community, whatever that looked like, something's gone wrong. Something's been fractured and needs to be put apart. And you know, I'm always reminded every time I read the New Testament that this is always, always how it goes in community. No matter how good or loving a community is, no matter how much good work has been done in the community, no matter how much people are growing and loving each other, no matter how well-intentioned and careful a community is, things always end up going wrong. Paul knows this, and so he encourages Philemon, because we all need that when things go wrong, right? When things go wrong and there's some hard ass coming, we need that encouragement. And then Paul launches into it, and it feels a bit like the Godfather here. Philemon, I need you to do me a favor, a personal favor. Is he asking? Is he telling? It's interesting. I like this, though. I could be very bold in the king and order you to do the right thing, but because of love, I'd much rather appeal to you, right? If he's wronged you in any way or owes you anything, put that down on my account. I'll pay you back. I'm confident that you'll do what I say. In fact, I know you'll do more than I say, but then at the same time, get a guest room ready for me. My Godfather's awful. I apologize. But I mean, come on. Paul is laying it on pretty thick here. I could order you, Philemon. But let me help you understand the right thing to do here. I mean, you do owe me your life, Philemon. I have a feeling you're going to do what I ask. Furthermore, can you get a guest room ready? Because I'm coming to check up on you in a short little while. I mean, no question, this is a full-out power move by Paul. Though I would argue this, I think it's a fantastic example of power being used in the best possible way. But it's an incredible, risky move, and not nearly as powerful a move as Paul could have made. I mean, consider how risky this is for Onesimus, the runaway slave. Imagine him talking to Paul, wait, what, you want me to go back? To Philemon, back to my slave owner with a letter? What if he kills me before he even opens it? What if I get beaten? What if I'm abused? This is risky, Paul. Of course it is. The Christian path isn't safe. And you might be thinking, are you saying, Brad, that the Christian path asks a lot from victims in a world? You bet it does. But Paul knows what he's doing here, and he knows what's at stake. This is risky, yes. And so Paul's performing like a bit of this dance here. He's operating with this knife-edged delicacy, because Paul is giving this letter to Onesimus and having him, the runaway slave, take it back to Philemon. It's risky for Onesimus, but you know who else it's risky for? Philemon. Philemon is being asked to do something unheard of here in the Roman world. This is not welcome back a runaway slave in the Pliny kind of way, like have him back, just show some mercy, get him back in slave headquarters doing his thing. No, no, no. Paul isn't asking Philemon to sweep this under the rug and look good in the process. No, 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 no. He says to him, welcome this runaway slave as if he was Paul himself. Welcome him back as a brother. Welcome him back as a full member of the family. I mean, this is what the Jesus path asks of all of us. And for Philemon, that's risky. Because what might the neighbors think? What might the neighbors think? I mean, they might be thinking, oh, I see how Christians treat runaway slaves. Oh, okay, I know this Paul guy's soft on slavery. What if my slave starts to run away and Paul sends him back with a letter to me too? Well, then the whole world's going to end up in trouble and turned on its head, because then maybe slaves will start thinking about freedom, and yeah, maybe they will. And that is the inherent danger and risk here. This is a massive risk to everyone involved, to Onesimus, to Philemon, and also to Paul. And sure, Paul's working a power move here, but consider what real power might have looked like. Consider the alternatives. What could Paul have done? Well, he could have just said, hey, he could have helped Onesimus escape. Onesimus comes to him and he says, here, I'll help you take off, start a new life somewhere else. He could have also said, you know what, Philemon, I'm keeping him. He's useful to me. So you owe me, I'm just going to keep him. I mean, I think we can all probably sit here wishing, right, that the Bible explicitly, like the Ten Commandments said, you shall have no slaves, slavery is evil and wrong. We wish that Paul had said, Philemon, slavery is evil. It needs to end. It needs to be smashed. Smash the slavery, right? Be done with it. Free Onesimus and all the other slaves with it. There's a justice part of us that wants that, but Paul has something bigger in mind than justice. His approach is surely a time bomb on slavery anyway. There's a direct correlation between what Paul does and, I would say, the end of slavery, even though it took centuries. I think what Paul's thinking is bigger than that. You see, for Paul, the key was this. something has gone wrong with Onesimus and Philemon. In the book of 2 Corinthians, Paul talks to us, the church, about being tasked with the ministry of reconciliation. And this ministry was serious. It was massive. He believed, Paul did, that through Jesus, the whole world was being reconciled. And our job as Jesus path followers, as Christians, as the church, is to participate in that. Notice his words to Philemon. You could have him back forever, no longer as a slave, but much more than a slave, as a beloved brother. The primary thing for Paul is reconciliation. Everything else is negotiable from there. And what Paul is Godfather like suggesting is this: welcome him back, Philemon, set him free. Reconcile, then freedom. Because in reality, reconciliation is the only thing that sets people free. And what Paul is trying to do is wrap one arm around Philemon, one arm around Onesimus, and join them together in his own person. Come, Philemon, let us abandon the way of Pliny. There's something much better than that. So Paul opts for a risky, dangerous strategy. Things could go very, very wrong, horribly wrong for everyone involved. But the thing is this: no one in the ancient world had thought quite like this. This was unprecedented thinking. No one was thinking like Paul. Very few people today are thinking like Paul. No one in the ancient world was attempting reconciliation across the largest cultural barrier of the day: slave and master. But Paul was, because he saw himself as a minister of reconciliation. And he's charged us, the church, with the same task. You know, what Jesus launched and what Paul passionately carried the mantle of was quite simply the new way, the Jesus way of being human. Jesus started the possibility of living an entirely different mode of being. And here's the thing: the new way of being human isn't something that takes the world by storm or comes with big fanfare. The new way of being human, the way of reconciliation, starts person to person, household by household, family by family, community by community. And to be honest, this is how Christianity spread. Second, third century, as the Roman Empire was doing its best to stamp out Christianity, something was catching on because people were living differently. And I'm convinced today it's the same. It's the small acts of forgiveness and reconciliation that the axis of the world is tilted on. That is how Jesus saves the world. That is how Jesus redeems the world, through people like you and me refusing to play the Pliny impulse, even if it makes us look good, refusing to give in to the revenge impulse, refusing to just allow things to remain as is, but to choose Paul's way, which is to see others around us, even those we think we're better than, even those we think are enemies, to see them as part of the same family. Is it risky? Of course it is. But it's the Jesus pathway. And sometimes it asks a lot of us. These things hurt. In fact, they can even make us more angry. So yes, reconciliation is always risky. But reconciliation is how Jesus chooses to save and redeem. Friends, I hope you have a great weekend. Go in peace.